who've been able to bend the rules. Joseph nods at someone over her left shoulder, and Jules turns to see Autumn, a priestess from Wolfspring Temple, approaching with a somber expression.
Jawien Malone, she says gently. Forgive the intrusion. The temple wishes to welcome Joseph Sandrin back to his home. We would take him and his family to the altar to receive a blessing.
Of course, Jules says.
Can it not wait?
Joseph asks and grumbles when the priestess does not reply. On the eastern hill of Wolfspring, Wolfspring Temple sits tucked, a white circle of bricks surrounded by small priestess cottages. Autumn is one of only 12 priestesses who reside there. It has seemed to Jules a lonely place whenever she has gone to pray. Except on festival days, the temple is mostly empty save for Autumn, tending the grounds and the others in the gardens.
And as always, Autumn says, we extend an invitation to Queen Arsinoe to receive a blessing.
Jules nods. Arsinoe has never set foot inside the temple. She says she will not pray to a goddess with a turned back.
Listen, Joseph says, I will come to you when I'm ready, if I come at all.
Autumn's serene face falls to a scowl. She turns on her heel and leaves.
That was not much of a welcome, Jules says. I'm sorry. This is all the welcome I need.
Joseph puts his arm across her shoulders.
You, here, and my family. Come and say hello to them. I want you all with me, for as long as I can have you.
Madrigal tells Arsinoe that they are going into the hills after a pheasant. She will charm them, and Arsinoe will shoot them.
You have never gone hunting in your life, Arsinoe says, shouldering her small crossbow and bag of bolts. What are we really going to do?
I don't know what you mean, Madrigal replies. She tosses her pretty light brown hair, but the way she glances through the kitchen window, where Kate stands preparing a stew, tells Arsinoe that she is right. Together, they walk far north of the house, up the trail past the clearing and dogwood pond, and into the cover of the forest. Arsinoe sinks past her ankles into snow. Madrigal hums a little tune, graceful despite the drifts. Her familiar, Aria, flies far ahead above the trees. She never sits on Madrigal's shoulder, like Eva sits on Kate's. It is almost like they are not familiar bonded at all. Or perhaps it is only that Aria never matches the outfits that Madrigal likes to wear.
Madrigal? Where are we going?
Not far.
It has been far already. They have walked up high, where large gray stones break through the ground. Some are only rocks, and some are the mostly buried remains of monoliths from back when the island was truly old and wore a different name. In winter, though, they are hidden under snow and slippery. Arsinoe has almost fallen twice. Madrigal changes her course and walks along a rise to the leeward side, where the snow is less deep. It is an odd little spot, where the thick trunk and bare branches of a tree bend over to form a sort of canopy. At the base of the hill, Madrigal has hidden a cache of dry wood and two small three-legged stools. She hands one of the stools to Arsinoe and begins arranging the wood for a fire, weaving in slender pieces of kindling. Then she pours oil from a silver flask onto the lot of it and lights it with a long match. It whooshes up, hot. The logs catch quickly.
Not so bad for a naturalist, Madrigal says. Though it would be easier if I were an elemental. Sometimes I think I'd rather be almost anything than a naturalist.
Even a poisoner? Arsinoe asks.
If I were a poisoner, I would be living in a grand house in Indrid Down, rather than my mother's drafty cottage by the sea.
But no, I was thinking perhaps of the war gift. To be a warrior would be much more exciting than this, or to have the sight and know what will come to be.
Arsinoe plunks her stool down near the fire. She does not mention that the Malone house is much more than a drafty cottage by the sea. That is all Madrigal will ever think of it as.
Why did you come back? Arsinoe asks. If you are so dissatisfied, you were 6 years on the mainland, and you could have stayed there.
Madrigal prods the flames with a long stick. Because of Jules, of course, she says.
I couldn't stay away and let her be raised by my dull sister.
She pauses. She knows she has spoken out of turn. No one in the family will hear one word spoken against Kara, not since she took Jules's place in the Black Cottage. How that must annoy Madrigal, who hardly has a kind word to say.
And you, Madrigal says and shrugs.
A new queen. I wasn't even born when the last one was crowned, so I could not miss this. You are the only excitement this island has seen in all that time.
Yes, excitement, says Arsinoe. I imagine my death will be very exciting.
Do not be so dour, Madrigal says.
I am on your side, unlike half these people.
Why do you think I've brought you all the way up here?
Arsinoe sets her crossbow and bolts beside her foot and stuffs her chilly hands into her pockets. She should have refused to come. But with Jules in Wolf Spring with Joseph, it was either this or chores.
What do you think my Joienne is doing down in town? Madrigal muses, fiddling with something in her coat.
She pulls out a small bag and sets it in her lap.
Welcoming home an old friend, Arsinoe says. Her best friend.
You are her best friend, Madrigal says slyly. Joseph Sandrin has always been something else.
She pulls four things out of her bag. A curving braid of hair, a strip of gray cloth, a length of black satin ribbon, and a sharp silver knife.
Low magic, Arsinoe observes.
Don't call it that. That is the temple talking. This is the lifeblood of the island, the only thing that remains of the goddess in the outside world.
Arsinoe watches Madrigal set out the items in a careful row. She cannot deny being fascinated. There is a peculiar bend to the air here, and a peculiar feeling in the ground, like a heartbeat. It is strange that she has never stumbled across this place and this bent-over tree before. But she has not. If she had, she would have known immediately.
Be that as it may, Arsinoe says, low magic is not a queen's gift. We aren't like everyone else. Our line is,
she stops. Sacred, she almost said. Of the goddess. It is true, but the words turn the inside of her mouth bitter.
I shouldn't do it, she says. I should go down to the water and yell at a crab until it prostrates itself before me.
How long have you tried that? Madrigal asks. How many times have you called for a familiar who hasn't come?
It will come.
It will. If we raise your voice.
Madrigal smiles. Arsinoe never thinks of Madrigal as beautiful, though many, many people do. Beautiful is too gentle a word for what she is.
Jules will help me raise it, Arsinoe says.
Don't be stubborn. Jules may not be able to. For her, things come too easy. The gift is there, at her fingertips. She reminds me of my sister that way.
She does?
Yes. Kara opened her eyes one day and had the gift. All of it, just like Jules. It was not as brutally strong as Jules's is, but it was strong enough to turn my parents' heads. And she did it without work.
Madrigal stokes the fire and sends up sparks.
I have wondered sometimes if Kara isn't somehow really Jules's mother, even though I remember giving birth to her. They were so close after I returned to the island. Jules even looks more like her.
So, uglier, you mean? Arsinoe frowns.
I didn't say that.
What else can you mean? You and Kara look similar, and Jules looks nothing like either of you. The only feature she and Kara share is that they are both less pretty than you. Jules bonded with Kara, but what can you expect? You were gone. Kara raised her.
Raised her, Madrigal repeats. She was scarcely 9 years old when I returned.
She takes up the cloth in her lap and tears away errant threads until the edges are clean.
Maybe I do feel guilt for leaving, she says, staring down at her work. Maybe that's why I am doing this now.
Arsinoe studies the strip of gray cloth. She studies the braid of dark brown hair and wonders who it belonged to. Beneath the bent-over tree, the breeze has stilled, and even the fire burns quietly. Whatever it is Madrigal is doing, they should not be doing it. Low magic is for the simple or the desperate. Even when it works, there is always a price. Have you noticed that no one is panicking that your gift hasn't come? Madrigal asks. Not Kate, not Ellis, not even really Jules. No one thinks you are going to survive, Arsinoe. Because naturalist queens do not survive. Not unless they're beasts, like Bernadine and her wolf. She ties a knot in the strip of cloth and uses it to anchor another knot around the braid of hair. Great Queen Bernadine, Arsinoe mutters. Do you know how tired I am of hearing about her? She is the only naturalist queen anyone remembers. She is the only one worth remembering, Madrigal says. And for all their savagery, the people of Wolf Spring have gotten used to that. They have accepted it. But I haven't. Why haven't you? Arsinoe asks. I am not sure, Madrigal says and shrugs. Maybe because I have watched you, growing up in Jules's gifted shadow, the way I did in Kara's. Or maybe because I want my daughter to love me, and if I save you, she might learn to. She holds up the bit of braid and cloth. Arsinoe shakes her head. It will go wrong. Something always does when it comes to me. Someone will get hurt. It will hurt when your sisters kill you, Madrigal reminds her, and presses the charm into Arsinoe's hand. It seems like a harmless bit of junk, but it does not feel that way. It feels far heavier than any braid and strip of cloth should feel, and more alive than any rosebud in her hand. The goddess is here, in this place, Madrigal says. The priestesses pray to her like she is a being, some faraway creature. But you and I know better. We feel her inside the island, everywhere. You felt her in the mist that night, in the boat, when she would not let you go. She is the island, and the island is her. Arsinoe swallows. The words feel true. Perhaps once the goddess was everywhere, stretched out over the sky all the way to the mainland. But now she is drawn in, curled up like a beast in a hole, just as powerful, just as dangerous. Is this Jules's hair? Arsinoe asks. Yes, I took it when I was brushing it this morning to put into a bun. It took forever to straighten it and braid it together. What about the cloth? It looks old, wrinkled, and dirty. A strip of Joseph's shirt from when he was a boy, or so my mother says. He ruined it on a nail out by the barns, and Jules kept it after she gave him a new one. I don't know how she remembers these things, she snorts. Of course, there are other things of Joseph's that we could use, but we don't want him charging Jules like a rutting stag. This is a love spell, Arsinoe says. You are teaching me to use low magic to do a love spell for Jules? Is there any motivation in the world more pure? Madrigal hands her the length of black ribbon. Wrap them together, and then tie them around with this. How do you know how to do this? Arsinoe asks. Though in truth it feels almost as if she herself knows how to do it. Her fingers twist the braid and cloth together effortlessly, and she would have known to reach for the ribbon, even if Madrigal had not instructed her to. Off the island, there is nothing else, Madrigal whispers. Close your eyes. Look into the flames. Jules would want to do this herself, Arsinoe says. No, she would not do it at all. She does not need this. Across the fire, Madrigal purses her lips ruefully. Every girl in Wolf Springs knows about the Sandrin boys, their mischievous smiles and eyes like storm clouds reflected upon the sea. All that wind in their dark hair. Joseph will be that way now. And even though Arsinoe loves Jules and thinks of her as beautiful, she knows that Jules is not the kind of beautiful that holds a boy like that. Arsinoe looks down at the charm, winding itself between her fingers. Moments ago, it was a scrap of nothing, to be tossed into the bin or for birds to use to line their nests. But there is more to it in the knots that Madrigal tied,
and the twists where Jules's hair and Joseph's shirt press tightly together. She finishes the last wrap of the ribbon and secures the end. Madrigal takes up the silver knife and slices into the underside of Arsinoe's forearm so fast that it takes the wound a few seconds to bleed.
Ow, says Arsinoe.
It didn't hurt.
It did, and you could have warned me before you did it.
Madrigal shushes her and presses the charm into the running blood. She squeezes Arsinoe's arm, squeezing her into the charm like milk into a bucket. A queen's blood, Madrigal says. The blood of the island. Thanks to you, Jules and Joseph will never be parted again. Arsinoe closes her eyes. Jules and Joseph. They were inseparable since birth, until she came along, until they tried to save her and were parted for their trouble. The Black Council imposed no punishment on Arsinoe for her part in the escape, except for guilt. And in the years since, guilt over Jules losing Joseph has punished her plenty. Madrigal releases her arm and Arsinoe bends at the elbow. The bleeding has lessened, and the cut begins to throb. Madrigal did not think far enough ahead to bring along anything to cleanse the wound, or bandages. So perhaps the price of the magic will be the loss of a queen's arm. Madrigal slides the charm into a small black bag. When she hands the pouch to Arsinoe, her fingers are sticky and red, and the charm inside feels like a small heart beating. After it dries, Madrigal says, keep it somewhere safe, under your pillow, or braid it into your own hair, if you can keep from constantly cutting it. Arsinoe holds the charm in her fist. Now that the magic is made, it feels wrong. A crooked thing, twisted through with good intentions. She does not know why she did it. She has no excuse except that it was easy, and nothing has ever come easily to her before. I can't do this to Jules, she says. I can't take away her will like this. No matter the reason, she wouldn't want it. Before she can reconsider, Arsinoe throws the charm into the fire. The bag burns away like nothing, and Jules's hair and Joseph's dried scrap of shirt blacken and curl like the legs of a dying insect. The smoke that comes from it is foul. Madrigal cries out and jumps to her feet. Put the fire out, and let's go home, Arsinoe says. She tries to sound like a queen, but she is shaky and weak, as if she has lost a pint of blood, rather than a few spoonfuls. What have you done? Madrigal asks sadly. What have you just done to our poor Jules?
Rolanth. In the cloistered courtyard on the eastern side of the temple grounds, Mirabella can be alone. It is one of the few places the priestesses will let her go unescorted. One of the few places they feel is safe. Even when she prays at the altar, one or two of them are there, standing in the shadows. Only in the courtyard and in her bedroom at Westwood House may she be by herself, free to think or recline and even to weep. She has wept often since Roe's test in the cliffs. Most of the tears she has hidden, but not all. Word of her upset traveled quickly and the priestesses have begun to give her suspicious glances. They cannot decide whether her weeping is a sign of weakness or of great mercy. Either way, they would prefer that she did not do it. Mirabella tucks her legs underneath her on the cold stone bench. As she lifts her foot, a small black-and-white tufted woodpecker lands in her footprint and hops back and forth. Oh, she says. It is a sprightly thing with smart black eyes. She pats the pockets of her skirt and gently shakes the folds of her cloak. I am sorry. I have no seed for you. She ought to have brought some. The dove's cooing would have been a welcome distraction. It is not seed he's after. Mirabella turns. A young initiate stands at the entrance of the courtyard in the opening of the snow-crusted hedge. She holds her white hood tight against the chill of the wind. Mirabella clears her throat. What is he after, then? The girl smiles and walks into the courtyard. He wishes to cheer you, she says. She releases her hood and the woodpecker flits quickly from the ground to dive into her collar. The queen's eyes widen.
You are a naturalist, she says.
The girl nods. My name is Elizabeth. I grew up in Bernadine's Landing. I hope you don't mind the intrusion. It is only that you looked so sad. And Pepper always manages to make me smile.
The little bird pokes his beak out from behind her hood and disappears again just as quickly.
Mirabella watches with interest. She has never seen a familiar. In the temple, a priestess gives up her gift, and familiars are forbidden.
How is it that you have managed to keep him? Mirabella asks.
Elizabeth rubs her tan cheek against the bird's head.
Please don't tell anyone. They would kill him on sight. I have tried to keep him away, but he will not go.
I suppose I'm lucky that he is easy to hide.
It is cruel to make us send them away before we take our bracelets.
What if I change my mind and leave the temple?
Where will Pepper be then?
In the woods nearby or high in the mountains where he may never hear my call?
It is cruel to make you give him up at all, says Mirabella.
Elizabeth shrugs.
My mother says that once, priestesses did not have to, but now the island is so fractured. Naturalist against poisoner, against elemental. Even those few with the war gift, or those fewer with the sight gift, are hostile to one another.
She looks at Pepper and sighs. Giving them up unites us, and the sacrifice binds us to our faith. But you are right. It's still cruel.
Could I? Mirabella asks, and holds out her hand.
Elizabeth smiles, and the little bird flies quickly to perch on the tips of Mirabella's curled fingers.
He likes you, Elizabeth says.
Mirabella chuckles.
That is kind.
But you are a naturalist. This bird will do whatever you say.
That's not exactly how the familiar bond works. And in any case, you would be able to tell.
He would be hesitant and less bright-eyed. He might leave droppings in your palm.
Lucky he likes me then, Mirabella says.
Pepper blinks once and then shoots quickly back into the safety of Elizabeth's hood.
Seeing you here alone, so sad. I had to see if we could help.
Elizabeth settles down onto the bench beside her.
I know why you cry.
I imagine every priestess in the temple knows.
Elizabeth nods.
But it means something special to me, she says, as I was almost the girl sacrificed.
You?
The way they make it sound, she says, the duty and the commune with the goddess. I almost said yes. I thought I should.
Her name was Laura, the volunteer. She died believing she had done a great service, and there are worse ways to die than that.
Worse ways, like being burned alive by your sister priestesses.
Mirabella tried that way of thinking, telling herself that she had saved the girl from the flames.
It did not work. It was not right, no matter how it happened.
We are all dual-natured, Queen Mirabella. Every gift is light and dark. We naturalists can make things grow, but we also coax lobsters into pots, and our familiars tear rabbits to shreds.
Yes, says Mirabella. I know this. Elementals burn down forests as easily as they water them with rain. The war gift is for protection, as well as slaughter. Even those with the sight are often cursed with madness and paranoia. It is for that reason that any queens born with the sight are drowned.
Even the poisoners, Elizabeth says, are also healers.
Now that I have not heard, says Mirabella.
Poisoners are notoriously vicious. Every one of their executions is a mess. When every executed woman or man is put to death by flamboyant poisons that bring blood to the eyes and spasms so hard they break their backs.
It's true, Elizabeth insists. They know the ways of healing. They have only forgotten it in the face of their hunger for council seats.
Mirabella smiles slightly. Then she shakes her head.
But it is not the same, Elizabeth. It is not the same for queens.
Oh, I know that, the priestess replies, and I have only been here at Rolinth for a short time.
But already I can see that you are a good person, Mirabella.
I don't know if you will make a good queen, but that seems to me a promising start.
A dark black braid slides out of Elizabeth's hood, almost as dark as the queen's own. It reminds Mirabella of Bree, the way she wears it. Pepper the woodpecker ruffles his feathers. He seems to be a bird of few words.
You are the only priestess here who has ever really spoken to me, Mirabella says. I mean, besides Luca.
Am I? Elizabeth asks. Oh dear, yet another sign that I am not a very good priestess. Ro is always telling me so. Perhaps she is right.
Bloodthirsty Ro, the terror of the temple. Mirabella cannot remember ever seeing her be kind or hearing her utter a word softly spoken. But she will be good protection once Beltane is over and the ascension begins. Luca is right about that.
Elizabeth cocks her head. You are feeling a little better now?
I am, says Mirabella.
Good. That rite, the rite of sacrifice, you can be sure it was Ro's idea. She wants to bring back the old ways and supplant the council once more for the temple. She thinks she can do this by force, as if she alone is the goddess's hand. But she is not.
Elizabeth smiles brightly.
You are.
You said she did it, the High Priestess says. And so it is done.
I did not say that she did it well, says Ro. Ro picks up a trinket from the corner of Luca's mahogany desk, a shiny, polished orb of opal, and makes a face. She does not like the High Priestess's rooms, up in the top floor of the temple, overlooking the cliffs of Shannon's Blackway. They are too soft, lined with pillows and blankets against the drafts. They are too cluttered, full of things, decorative things that have no use, like mosaic vases and carved gilded eggs, like the little opal. Luca watches Ro wind back her arm to cast it out the window.
Do not do that, the High Priestess cautions. That was a gift.
It is only a rock.
It was still a gift. And close that window. The breeze is cold today.
I cannot wait for spring. The fires of Beltane leading to hot summer nights.
Will you take some soup? The kitchen tells me it is rabbit and cabbage and cream.
Luca, says Ro, you are not listening. The rite was a farce. Our queen was backed into a corner, and even then she would do nothing until we first let the girl feel the fire.
Luca sighs.
The sacrifice lies buried beneath a pile of fallen stones. She performed the rite. You cannot ask her to enjoy it.
Luca herself did not enjoy it. She had listened when they cautioned her about being too soft. She believed them when they said it would be Mirabella who would be hurt by it in the end. And now an innocent is dead, crushed under rocks that form a convenient monument to be prayed over.
We will not ask her to do anything like this again, Luca says.
You do not know her like I do. If we press her too hard, she will buck. And if Mirabella learns to buck, if she remembers how...
Luca looks out her west-facing window, through the trees to the roof of Westwood House. Even at that distance, the copper-cored lightning rods are still visible, standing up like stiff hairs. The Westwoods knew better, too, than to take them down.
You were not here, Luca adds, when they brought Mirabella from the Black Cottage. Neither was I. I was still in Indrid Down, fighting the Aran Council for any scrap of power. I would not have believed Sarah Westwood when she came and told me that our 6-year-old queen was going to tear her house from beneath her feet, had it not been for the look on her face. The island has not seen a gift like hers in hundreds of years. Not since Shannon and the queens of old. We are its keepers, but not its masters.
That may be, says Ro. But if she does not rise to her duty, the Black Council will keep its stranglehold for another generation.
Luca rubs her face, hard. Perhaps she is too old for this, too exhausted from a life spent trying to wrest power from the Arryns. But Ro is right. If another poisoner queen sits the throne,
The errands of the Black Council will rule until the next set of triplets comes of age. By the time that happens, Luca will be long dead.
Mirabella will rise, the High Priestess says, and the temple will rein back the council. Full up with Westwoods, it will be much easier to control.
Some days later, Mirabella wakes from another dream, with her mouth tasting of blood. In the dream, she, Arsinoe, and Catherine had been children. She remembers black hair, fanned out in water, and dirt on Arsinoe's nose. She remembers her own hands, turned to claws and tearing Arsinoe and Catherine apart. She rises up on her forearms from being face down in her pillows. It is midday, and her room is empty. Perhaps there are not even any priestesses lurking outside her door, since Sarah, Bree, and the other Westwoods are all at home. The dreams are coming more frequently. They wake her too, sometimes 3 times a night. Lucas said to expect them, that they would show her the way. She did not warn her of the dread they would make her feel. Mirabella closes her eyes, but instead of darkness, she sees the face of the sacrificed priestess in the rocks. She sees Arsinoe's dirty nose. She hears Catherine's laugh. Queens are not supposed to love their sisters. She has always known that, even when they were together at the Black Cottage, where she had loved them anyway. They are not those children anymore, she whispers into her hands. They are queens. They must die. Bree knocks on her door and pokes her head in, her long brown braids swinging over her shoulder. Is it time? Mirabella asks. Today they are to go into the city, where Roland's best artisans wait to present their finest jewels and gowns for the Beltane ceremonies. Nearly, Bree says, but do not sound so glum. Look who has come from the temple. Bree swings the door wide, and Elizabeth leans in from the opposite side. Mirabella smiles. Oh no, she says. People will start saying that I will only be friends with girls who wear braids. After Mirabella is readied and dressed, she, Bree, and Elizabeth climb into a coach waiting in front of Westwood House. Sarah is already inside. Very good, Sarah says and taps the roof, signaling the driver to depart. It is kind of you to join us, priestess. She smiles at Elizabeth. The temple will surely approve of our choices today. Oh, I am not here for temple approval. Elizabeth grins happily, watching the city rumble past. I'm only escaping my chores. Sarah's lips draw into a thin line, and Bree giggles. We are happy to have you in any case, says Sarah. Mira, are you well? You seem pale. I'm fine, Sarah. Sarah taps the roof harder, and the driver urges the horses to go faster. Perhaps you are needing something to eat. There will be plenty when we arrive at the park. Moorgate Park sits in the central district that runs alongside the channel. In spring, it is pretty, full of trees and pale stones with a gurgling ivory fountain. This time of year, the trees are bare and the grounds more open. Plenty of room for the jewelers and tailors to present their wares. I hope the tailor from Third Street brought that handsome son of his, Bree says. I thought you were seeing the Wexton boy, says Sarah. Bree snuggles back into the coach's velvet cushions. Not anymore. Since Mira's birthday, he has forgotten how to kiss. So much tongue. She shivers and gags and leans against Mirabella for comfort. Mirabella and Elizabeth laugh. Sarah says nothing, but her eyes bulge out and her lips practically disappear. Mirabella looks out the window. They are nearly there. In the central district, the buildings are broad and white. What cracks there are have been carefully hidden with paint. Here, one can see how fine the city of Roland once was. One can see how fine it will be again, after Mirabella takes the throne. Here we are, says Sarah, as the coach jerks to a stop. She smooths the skirt of her long black dress and prepares to exit the carriage. Bree, she mutters, please try not to wander off. Yes, mother, Bree says and rolls her eyes. Mirabella steps out after Sarah. Through the park's open gate, she can see the jewelers and dressmakers waiting in a row, and the priestesses, of course, always on guard. Bree cranes her neck.
"He is here," she says and grins.
It is easy to see who she means. A handsome boy with light brown hair stands beside the jeweler near the end of the row. He has already seen Bree as well.
"It never takes you very long," Mirabella says quietly.
"Nor should it. I have had years of practice."
Bree grasps Mirabella's arm in one hand and Elizabeth's in her other.
"We must find out his name."
"Enough of that," Sarah says. She unlinks the girl's arms and takes her place behind the queen.
"Mother," Bree groans, "we are only picking out jewels. You do not have to treat it like the disembarking."
"Everything public will be formal after she is crowned," says Sarah. "You had best get used to it." As they enter the park, Sarah motions to one of the novice priestesses.
"Queen Mirabella has not eaten today. Would you please prepare her something?"
The girl nods and scurries away. Mirabella is not really very hungry. The dreams of her sisters often leave her with no appetite until evening. But it will be easier to nibble than to argue with Sarah. The merchants bow when they approach the tables. The Westwoods will purchase something small from everyone, a ring or a bracelet, a scarf. Only a select few will be commissioned for gowns or sets of gems.
"I can tell you without looking that we will only be buying handkerchiefs at the first table," Sarah says into Mirabella's ear. "That woman has no sense of elemental movement. Everything she sews is tight and severe, fit for a poisoner."
Approaching the woman's stall, Mirabella can see that Sarah is right. It is all shimmer, and each gown is close-fitted. But the tailor is so nervous, so hopeful.
"Those are very fine gloves," Mirabella says before Sarah can speak.
"Do you also work in leather?" She half turns to Sarah. "Bree has need of a new pair for archery, and little Nico must be outgrowing his."
"Yes, Queen Mirabella," the merchant says. "I particularly enjoy working with leather."
Mirabella leaves the table so that Sarah may discuss fees and to keep from hearing her grind her teeth. From the next merchant, she selects rings of twisted silver, and the next of polished gold, as Bree tugs her along in her hurry to meet her brown-haired boy. The novice priestess returns with a tray of cheeses and bread, and a small jar of preserved tomatoes. Elizabeth takes it from her.
"Bree, slow down," she says and laughs. "Take a moment to eat."
She does, but they are only one table away from her boy now, and the way she nibbles her cheese is highly suggestive.
"We must find something to distract her," Elizabeth whispers to Mirabella. "Perhaps these gowns? They are beautiful."
"I do not think any gown can distract her," Mirabella says, "no matter how beautiful." The dressmaker studies Bree. He reaches beneath his table.
"Perhaps this one," he says, and unfurls it before them.
Mirabella and Elizabeth are speechless. Bree drops her cheese. It is not a gown for a queen. Those must be all in black. This one has a bodice embroidered with blue waves, and a gathered train of storm blue satin cuts through the black skirt. It is splendid.
"This is the one," says Mirabella.
She turns to Bree and touches her braid fondly.
"You will outshine me in this. All the suitors will look at you."
"No," Elizabeth says. "That is not true, Mira." "Perhaps it is not. A queen's raven black hair and strange black eyes always command attention." But Elizabeth misunderstood. Mirabella is not jealous. She could never be jealous of Bree. Sarah rejoins them and nods her approval.
"We will have three gowns," she says, "including this one to fit my daughter. Perhaps more if we do not find anything else equal to your skill. I will call upon your shop to discuss them further."
"Finally," Bree whispers into Mirabella's ear. They have reached the jeweler and the boy.
"We will speak to his father, not to him," Mirabella says.
"How will you manage this?" Bree motions discreetly with her chin. The merchant and his son have a small, stout brazier set back from the table to keep warm as they wait. Perhaps they are not elementals then, or perhaps their gifts are merely weak. Bree throws her arm around Elizabeth.
Sweet Elizabeth, she says, you are shivering.
She turns to the boy. May we come round and stand beside your fire?
Of course,
he says quickly. Mirabella's lips curl as he leads Bree and Elizabeth to the brazier. With a lazy flick of her wrist, Bree sends flames jumping up from the red embers. She looks over her shoulder at Mirabella and winks.
Good, says Sarah in a low voice. I thought we would have to buy out the display just to give her more time to flirt.
But perhaps they will anyway. The jeweler's pieces are exquisite. Laid out across the table, carefully cut gems sparkle in ornate settings. Mirabella's hand drifts to a necklace of three vibrant red-orange stones hanging from a short silver chain. Even on the table in the winter light, they seem to burn. I would like this one, she says, for the night of the quickening. After the purchases are made, they return to the carriage. Mirabella holds the fire necklace on her lap in a velvet case. She cannot wait to show it to Luca. She is sure the High Priestess will like it. Perhaps, after the quickening is over, Mirabella will make a gift of it to her. Now that that is finished, Sarah says when the cart starts moving, there has been some news from Wolf Spring, if you can imagine.
News?
Bree asks. What news?
It seems they are housing a suitor there. His delegation has arrived early.
But that is not allowed, says Mirabella. Does the temple know? She looks to Elizabeth, but the initiate only shrugs.
They do, says Sarah. It is his family's first delegation. They are being given special treatment for a perceived disadvantage. To let them find their way here on such unfamiliar ground, and to repay them for fostering Joseph Sandrin during his banishment.
It has been a long time since I have heard that name, Mirabella says. She used to think of it often, whenever she thought of Arsinoe. He was the boy who tried to run away with her, who tried to help her escape. When they were caught, she heard that he spat at Natalia Aaron's feet. Now he brings Arsinoe a suitor. It must have been hard to do, when he had so much love for her himself.
I think you will meet him, Sarah says.
Joseph?
No, the suitor. Before Beltane, we will arrange for him to come here. Under the eye of the temple, of course.
It seems a shame, says Bree. All those suitors, and you can choose only one?
But still, all those suitors. She shivers with pleasure. Sometimes I wish that I was a queen.
Mirabella frowns. Do not ever say that.
Everyone in the coach quiets at the tone of her voice.
It was only a joke, Mira, says Bree gently. Of course I do not wish that.
No one really wishes to be a queen. Greavesdrake Manor. The great shadowy library of Greavesdrake is one of Catarine's favorite places. The large fireplace casts warmth everywhere, except into the very darkest corners. And as she grew, the tall shelves and massive leather chairs provided many places to hide from Genevieve's slaps or from poison practice. Today, though, the fire burns low, and she and Peter sit out in the open. They have pulled back three sets of curtains from the eastward-facing windows and huddle in the brightest shaft of light. Warmth from the sun feels better somehow. Gentler, and less hard-won. Peter hands her a bit of bread, smeared with soft triple-cream sheep's milk cheese. He has assembled a picnic on the carpet of the finest, untainted food he could find. A sweet gesture, even if it is mostly intended to fatten her up.
You ought to try the crab souffle, he says, before it gets cold.
I will, says Catarine.
She takes a bite of the bread and cheese, but it is difficult. Even the best foods taste like mud when accompanied by nausea. She touches the small bandage on her wrist.
What was it this time? Peter asks.
Some kind of snake venom. It was nothing she had not been poisoned with before, but the cut used to apply it was worse than necessary, thanks to Genevieve's still-held grudge from the night of the Gave Noir. Peter has looked at the wound already, and he did not like what he saw.
When you are crowned, he says, there will be no more reason for that.
He serves her a small plate of scrambled egg with caviar and soured cream. She takes a bite and tries to smile.
That is not a smile, Cat. That is a grimace.
Perhaps we should put this off, she suggests, until dinner.
And let you miss two more meals?
He shakes his head.
We have to recover your poisoner appetite. Try a pastry, or some juice at least.
Catherine laughs. You are the best personal attendant I have ever had, even better than Giselle.
Am I?
He raises an eyebrow.
I have had no practice. My house in the country is well fortified and well run by Marguerite, though I am loath to admit it. I have spent my whole life being waited upon.
Then perhaps you have learned by example, Catherine says. You care very much that I am crowned, but so does every Aaron. Did you really come here to escape the country? What did Natalia promise you?
She promised me a seat on the council, he says, after you are on the throne. But it is more than that.
He looks at her pointedly, and she blushes. He likes it when she blushes. He says that Mirabella is likely far too proud to show any pleasure at someone's interest.
Poisoner queens are good for the island. He feeds her another piece of bread. We have run it for 100 years. The Westwoods are arrogant indeed if they think they can do better.
The Westwoods, Catherine says, and the temple.
Yes, the temple. I do not know why they feel so slighted, why they have to possess the entirety of people's hearts, but they do.
Peter eats some bread smeared with apple jelly. He does not turn up his nose at untainted food like the rest of the Aarons do. He does not make Catherine feel small for being weak.
It smells like dust in here, Cat, he says. I do not know why you like it.
Catherine looked around at the tall stacks of leather-bound books. Queen Camille liked them, she says. She liked to read about mainland queens. Did you know that is where Arsinoe got her name?
I did not.
There was a queen on the mainland who was murdered by her sister. She was called Arsinoe too. So when Arsinoe was born weak, that is what she named her. Arsinoe the Naturalist.
Such a wicked way to name a newborn. I am almost sorry for her, says Peter.
The queen knows what we are from birth. She knows our gifts. A dud is a dud, even then.
She gave you a fine name, in any case. Catherine the Poisoner. She must have known then that you would grow up to be sweet and thoughtful.
He traces a finger along her cheek.
And very fair.
Fair enough to capture the eye of every single suitor? She asks. Must I really?
You must. Imagine the look on Mirabella's face when every one of them ignores her. Perhaps she will be so dismayed that she will throw herself off the Roland cliffs.
That would be very convenient indeed, though it would rob Catherine of the sight of her clawing at her throat after it had been poisoned shut. Catherine laughs.
What? Peter asks.
I was thinking of Arsinoe, she says, of how sad and easy she will be to kill after Mirabella is dead. Peter chuckles. He draws her close.
Kiss me, he says.
And she does. She is getting much better at it, and bolder. Afterward, she bites his lip gently. He is so very handsome. She could kiss him all day and never tire of it.
You are a fast learner, he says.
But were you? How many girls have you practiced on, Peter?
Many,
he replies.
Practically every serving girl who came through our household, and most of them in the village besides. As well as a few of my stepmother's more discerning friends.
I should not have asked, she pouts. He runs his hand up the side of her leg, and Catherine laughs. So many girls, so many women, but he is hers and hers alone. For now.
You do not find me dull, after others who were more practiced? She asks.
No,
he says and looks into her eyes.
Never.
In fact, the hardest part of all of this will be something that I had not really thought of.
What?
Remembering why I am here. To make you the kind of queen who wins hearts. To help you gain island support at the festival.
What does their support matter? They will not help me kill my sisters.
A well-loved queen has many eyes and ears. The support will matter very much, in any case, after you are crowned. Katarine's stomach lurches, and she pushes her food away. It is all pressure and expectations, and I will fail. I will fail, like I did on my birthday.
You will not fail, says Peter.
When you step onto your stage at the quickening, no one will bother looking at your sister's stages. When the suitors see you at the disembarking, they will forget that there are other queens to see.
But Mirabella...
Forget Mirabella. She will be stiff-backed and haughty. You will smile, flirt. You will be the queen they want. If I can only get you to stand up straight.
Stand up straight?
You are very meek when you walk, Kat. I want you to move through a room as though it is already yours. Sometimes it even seems that you scurry.
Scurry?
She laughs and shoves him away. He leans back on the carpet and laughs as well.
You are right, though. Sometimes I do scurry, like a rat.
She grins.
But that is over. You will teach me and I will make them forget their own names, with one look.
One look? Peter asks. That is a bold promise.
But I will do it, and I will make you forget as well.
Katarine lowers her lashes.
Forget what?
She looks up at him. That I am not for you.
When Natalia asks Katarine to accompany her to the Volroy, it can be for only one reason, to poison a prisoner. That is all she has ever gone to the palace for. She has never sat in session with the Black Council, listening to them discuss the tax on naturalist fruit or glass windows from Rolanth. Nor has she ever met with the last King Consort's representatives from the mainland when they come to press their interests. But that is all right, Natalia says. She will one day, when she is crowned.
He was tried in Kenora, Natalia says, as they take the carriage toward Indrid Down and the black spires of the Volroy. For murder. A stabbing and a brutal one. It did not take the council long to determine his punishment.
The coach stops momentarily on Edgemoor Street to be allowed through the side gate and onto the palace grounds. Katarine tilts her head back in the dark shadows of the fortress, but they are already too close for her to see the top of the spires. When she is crowned, she will live there, but she has never cared for the Volroy. Despite the grandeur of the twin spires with their flying buttresses, it is too formal and too full of hard surfaces. There are more windows and light than at Greavesdrake, yet the place is still cold. So many hallways and drafts slide through it like notes from a flute. Katarine leans away from the coach window as the ceiling closes over their heads.
Are Genevieve and Lucien here today? She asks.
Yes, perhaps we will meet with them afterward for lunch. I can make Genevieve sit at a separate table.
Katarine smiles. Genevieve has still not been allowed to move back into Greavesdrake, Natalia preferring to keep the house quiet. With luck, she will not be allowed to return until after Beltane is over. The coach stops, and they disembark and enter the building. People passing in the halls nod respectfully at the pair, buttoned up in their stark wool coats and topped with warm black hats. Katarine is careful to keep her sleeves tugged down to hide Genevieve's bandage and the last of the scabbing blisters. They have almost healed now, much faster than she expected. Thanks to Peter, she is healthier and stronger. Most of the scabs have flaked off and left fresh pink skin behind. None will scar. On the stairs that lead to the holding cells below, Katarine pauses. Deep places have always made her uncomfortable, and the holding cells have a distinct and unpleasant odor. They smell of cold and dirty ice. Whatever wind fails to escape the Volroy through its many upstairs windows falls down into the cells to rot. Is one murder his only crime? Katarine asks, as they tread carefully down the stone steps. The holding cells are usually reserved for prisoners of special importance, like those who have committed crimes against the Queen.
Perhaps he could have been dealt with in Kenora after the trial, Natalia admits. But I thought you could use the extra practice.
At the bottom, the cold ice smell gives way to the cell's true scent, human filth and sweat and fear. It is made more pungent by the close quarters and by the heat thrown off the many torches. Natalia sloughs her coat, and one of the guards holds her hand out to receive it before they duck through the low doorway. Another guard unlocks the last large metal door, shoving it aside so hard that the heavy steel bounces against the track. Of the many cells in the lower level, only one is occupied. The prisoner is backed into the far corner, with his knees drawn up to his chest. He seems dirty and tired, and not much more than a boy. Katarine grips the bars. He has been convicted of a murder. But scared as he looks now, she cannot imagine him committing one. Who did he kill? She asks Natalia.
Another boy, only a few years older than himself.
They have given him a blanket and some straw. The remains of his meager breakfast sit in the corner beside him, a small metal mug and a plate scraped clean by his fingers. The bars that separate them are solid, but she would have been safe had they been made of cloth. Whatever fight he had has drained out in the few days spent in the prison.
What is your name? She asks,
and in the corner of her eye sees Natalia frown. His name does not matter, but she would still like to know.
Walter Mills.
His eyes wobble. He knows what she has come to do.
Walter Mills, she says gently. Why did you kill that boy?
He killed my sister, he says.
Why is it not him in this cell then, instead of you?
Because they don't know. They think she ran away.
How do you know she did not? Natalia asks skeptically.
I just do. She wouldn't have gone.
Natalia leans close to Katarine's ear.
We do not know if what he says is true, she says. He has been tried. He is guilty. In any case, we can hardly bring the dead boy in for questioning.
Natalia sighs.
Have you seen enough?
Katarine nods. There is nothing to be done. The council has determined his fate, and now she knows everything she needs to know. His crime, his cause, his approximate health, age, and weight.
Please, the boy whispers. Mercy.
Natalia puts her arm across Katarine's shoulders and leads her out. It is not necessarily legal for Katarine to participate in executions before she is crowned, but there are no ends to the strings that Natalia can pull. Katarine has been going with her into the Chamber of Poisons almost since the moment of her claiming from the Black Cottage. Inside the chamber, high up in the East Tower, Katarine unbuttons her coat and throws it over one of Natalia's beloved wingback chairs. Her gloves she leaves on. They are close-fitting and insulated and will provide some protection in the event of a spill.
Are there details of the crime? She asks.
It was a stabbing with a short-bladed knife, Natalia answers. 16 times, according to the healer's report.
16 times. It is an excessive number that speaks of rage.
Evidence of rage might lend credence to Walter Mills's claims of vengeance, but she cannot really know. That is what makes it so difficult. The cabinets of poisons occupy two entire walls of the room. The collection has been amassed over the years, kept stocked and increased by countless Aran expeditions around the island and to the mainland. There are herbs and venoms and dried berries from every continent and every climate, carefully preserved and catalogued. Katarine's fingers flutter past the drawers. She mutters names of poisons as she goes. One day, she may use them to dispatch Mirabella and Arsinoe. Those will be fancy blends indeed. But for Walter Mills, she will not be too creative. She pauses on a drawer filled with vials of castor beans. Taken alone,